Alonso digs it out, sends it in the air, deep center field. There it goes! Pete Alonso, 3-0 New York.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, December the 15th, 2024. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets No G and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You get me on Instagram, TalkingMetsNoG, and I'd love for you to subscribe to the newsletter, Substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks on the Fan Sided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. Hope everybody's having a great Sunday afternoon here. Another hot stove edition of the Talking Mets podcast. A little bit of a different week. Obviously, the winter meetings has been wrapped up just a week ago. The Soto madness began. We're putting a little bow on top of that with the coronation. We talked about that on Friday with a special edition of the show. So wanted to come to you here on a Sunday. Normally, I probably would have packaged the Soto thing, the press conference with everything else, but I thought it deserved a standalone, so have pretty much another segment. And I'm going to try something different at about 7 o'clock. I come to you about 4 o'clock here on a Sunday. So obviously you're listening on Apple or replay. You know, you may be listening days after. But if you follow me on X at Talking Mets No G, and I know other people have asked, you know, are you going to join Blue Sky or something else? I'm trying to figure out, because I'm on Instagram, but I'm really not on Instagram. I mean, there's all these social media outlets. I do the writing, and obviously the hub is the podcast, and then the writing, and then everything else emanates, so trying to figure that all out. Right now, I've been on X for years, since pretty much 2009, so it's the biggest following, but you know, there's other options, I know that, and the spaces, I thought, when Anthony Rivera and I, during the postseason, interacted with you, I thought it brought some of that charm, some of that old blog talk radio call-in and chat room feeling. So going to try it again at Talking Mets Hot Stove Spaces at 7 o'clock. I'll be on from 7 to 8. We'll see how it goes. Probably should do a little bit better job promoting it days in advance, but decided to start about 3, 4 o'clock today because I wanted to keep it fresh in mind for those on X and what have you. I had teased it maybe on Saturday. But anyway, a lot to talk about. I want to put a little bit of a bow on the winter meetings. Had some non-Mets thoughts about the winter meetings, and I know everybody had talked about this golden at-bat that was floated by Rob Manfred. You know, when the league floats stuff, like whether it be when they were talking about the ghost runner for years, then they snuck it in there on the health and safety during COVID, and obviously the automatic strike zone, something they've been doing in the minors. And when they float stuff, they're considering it. So this golden at-bat, I didn't really have a chance to talk about it. I know it brought a lot of outrage across the span. I'll dive into that very briefly. I also think the winter meetings has kind of jumped the shark, and we use it kind of as this benchmark now. And maybe there's a way for baseball to spruce up the offseason. I think we're going to be headed to another long offseason with certain players. I think there'll be some action possibly the week coming up, but then I think you might get slow between now and New Year. You might see more action after January 1st than maybe you like. So talk a little bit about the winter meetings, but the main point of this show is the polar bear market, because word has come out as time has gone on that the Mets are looking to fulfill their promise to Juan Soto and sign another bat, and there's not many bats left out there. You have Pete, you have Alex Bregman, who's connected to the Mets. You have Anthony Santander and Teoscar Hernandez, who has not been connected to the Mets at all. And I don't see how he could be, as their outfield is full, unless he wants to DH or you're going to do something with Brandon Nimmo. There's some secondary fading stars. Maybe you could get on a prove-it deal like a Paul Goldschmidt and Anthony Rizzo. so on and so forth. But in general right now, maybe you go for DH like Jock Peterson. Obviously, Jesse Winker's still out there as well. In general, the big bats left are Pete Alonso and Alex Bregman and Teoscar Hernandez, and I'm going to take Hernandez out because I don't see any connection to the Mets. So we'll talk a little bit about Pete bringing him back, and obviously it sounds like, if you listen to Ken Rosenthal, that Boris and Alonso value their market a little bit differently than maybe the Mets do. Not surprised. I think that's something that's been going on for a while. So we'll get into Pete Alonso during this program. But let's start out with the winter meeting. So for years and years and years and years, I always look forward to the winter meetings. It'd be this like 4-day, and I think even this time it was less. Like sometimes they get done on Thursday. It looks like they got done on Wednesday this year. It felt like it never really started. But it would kick off on Sunday night. Sometimes you'd have big deals right away Sunday night. And every night, especially if they're on the West Coast, you'd wake up. It was almost like Christmas for baseball fans or holidays, whatever. And you would have some kind of deal. And there'd be action, and we would do shows, and we would do shows nightly and have chat rooms and call in. And it was like this big bonanza. But as time has gone on, it almost has been disappointing, particularly since COVID, since they started, they did them remote. They had to cancel them for a couple of years. And as you look at the modern game and you look at the amount of money being thrown around and you look at markets developing and with the luxury tax and every dollar really counting and players and a lot of the big teams holding things up like the Mets, like the Yankees, the winter meetings has become less and less really of a thing from a marketing perspective. Now, it's a trade show, and it's something that in essence is basically a professional trade show where people go look for jobs, maybe meet some vendors. Obviously, the sport gets together. It's always good to connect and collaborate, even though it's a sport now of text messaging and Zooms and phone. I mean, for what I understand, a lot of stuff gets done over text message. I mean, the advent of text message and how it's used probably changes the dynamic from even like a decade or plus ago. So you can understand why this is not as important. So this trade show, which was kind of marketed as a free agent trade bonanza, has lost its luster. And the question then is, because this was part of the criticism a year ago when guys like Blake Snell and Jordan Montgomery didn't sign until the spring, how can you spruce up the offseason? Sort of like how the NBA has figured it out, although that's dragged a little bit. You saw Karl Anthony Towns, the Knicks, that deal come together in September after Labor Day. But how can you do what you see on July 1st with the NBA, where there's move after move after move? There's almost like this flurry of activity for 2 weeks, and then the sport just basically shuts down for the summer and picks up right after Labor Day when the training camp is about 30 days out. And baseball's not like that. And maybe that's a good thing because it's always in your top of your mind and your conscious. In the NBA, I think after July 4th or the week after the 4th of July, you pretty much forget about it until when you say, oh, wow, it's September 1st, Labor Day is coming, and training camps should be starting in about a month, and the winter and the fall is almost here, and you get those last remnants of summer. So maybe it's a good thing, but I've been thinking a lot about the winter meetings, and you got to wonder, is there a way to, without compromising the market, without compromising players' financial earnings or ability to earn, to spruce this thing up? And I was thinking about a couple of things. First, you have like sort of like these qualifying offer deadlines. You have 5 days to accept the qualifying offer. I wonder if the league, and it would have to be collectively bargained, and I don't know if this would actually benefit the owners. It might benefit the players, but who knows? And I think back to the lockout and how there was a flurry of activity right after the lockout and before the lockout, if you remember. So is there a way to perhaps put a deadline of January 1st? Because think about it. Spring training pitchers and catchers start around the 15th. So what I was thinking is the World Series ends first week of November. You have that 5-day period with qualifying offers. If you're in the playoffs, obviously some of your planning gets delayed. But for the most part, 24 to 25 teams, forget the ones that get eliminated pretty quickly, have been planning already 30 days out while you're trying to win a pennant or a World Series. So when you think about it, the first week of November into the end of the year, January 1st, if you put a deadline as of New Year's Day, all Major League contracts have to be signed. That's all big league. Anybody who wants to be on a 40-man roster has to be signed by January 1st. And then after that, it's only minor league deals. Makes you wonder what kind of flurry of activity would go on with the trade market. Maybe you have a little bit of a trade deadline, so to speak. So then after January 1st, you could make trades up until, let's say, spring training starts, and then you can't make any trades till the season starts. And I think at that point, you would have almost a compartmentalized offseason where your free agents would take priority. And I'm not saying you wouldn't be able to make trades, but you would basically do January 1st. You could make trades after January 1st for 40-man guys, and the only guys you could sign as a free agent after January 1st through spring training and through pretty much the season are, until the season starts, are minor league deals. Because clearly you could sign anybody once the season starts and things like that. Or maybe once spring training starts. And I've been thinking about this because I'm like, what a flurry of action that would create. It would create this constant flow of transactions where now I feel like one of the big things that people are really getting tired of is like the rumor mill. Rumor mill used to be a cool thing. I think when the internet really started to explode in the late 90s and you had forums pop up and rumors across the country were starting to be published, it was a fun thing. And there's been plenty of insiders over the years that have come and gone. You know, you have some of the traditional ones left, the Rosenthals, the Haymans, the Jeff Passons that are more of your trusted sources. But I think people are kind of tired of the speculation and the conversation, even though it does create conversation about the sport. But I think it's gotten to a pretty much an unhealthy spot because now you've got a lot of this fake rumors and nobody really knows what's going on. I think it's creating the opposite. It's turning people off with like, you know, call me when somebody signs. So I wonder if it's doing the opposite in that sense. But if you were able to kind of have this flow, I think it might allow you to have a more action-packed offseason. The league is trying to make more action on the field with the stolen base rules, with the pickoff attempts, the ghost runner, all the things that they've tried to do, the pitch clock, to hurt the pitchers. Basically, because pitching is tough. Hard to hit now. We know it. With spin and all this other stuff, hard to hit. No matter what you do, taking away sticky stuff, technology and the science of pitching has, with the exception of keeping pitchers healthy, everything else about pitching with technology has made it a harder sport to hit and to have action. And you could talk about players' approach and everything, but it doesn't matter if you're a slap hitter, you're Tony Gwynn, or you're Juan Soto, or you're Pete Alonso, or whatever the power hitter, Aaron Judge. It's really hard to hit, no matter what your approach is at the plate. So why not bring action to the offseason? Because right now, the thing that plagued your sport, and maybe still plagues your sport, which is a lot of downtime, a lot of non-action, your offseason is a lot of action, is a lot of lack of action. Now, Soto made up the conversation for about a month, but that was limited to a few teams. The two New York teams, Boston, Toronto, maybe you want to throw in Philadelphia. I mean, it was laughable when they threw the Rays into there. Soto's going to go play in Tampa in a minor league at Steinbrenner Field? I mean, come on. That's where the rumor mill goes a little bit wacky. And, you know, you had the Max Fried deal and you've got some other, you know, smaller transactions, you know, Severino, things like that. But let's face it, it's been slow and I don't think it's going to go any faster because look at a team like the Mets. They have to figure out and they could do more than one thing. But when you're talking about the luxury tax, when you're talking about trying to maximize, if you're on the player's side, if you're the agent, trying to maximize the earnings, sometimes you got to play a little bit of that poker. Brian Cashman was on with Jim Duquette after the winter meetings on the MLB Network radio show. And he made a good point and something that actually was the opposite of what we had heard during the negotiations with Soto, that basically they were in the dark for a week. All the final offers were put in right after Thanksgiving, as we had heard. And as I had tweeted out on that Sunday, that everything's really been offered. It's a matter of where he wants to go and finalizing the damn thing. So, you know, and he even said back in the day when he got CeCe Sabathia, they talked about this secret meeting and recruitment like he was John Calipari or some college coach recruiting Sabathia out in Vegas. But let's face it, he said, I offered him the most money. So sometimes it's not all that exciting. It's not all that clandestine. And, you know, just like us, we're all sitting around waiting for an answer. And a lot of that has to do with negotiations, but it does hold up the market. It does hold up teams from doing things. And obviously, if you're a player that's interested in maximizing their value, or in the case of Sean Manaea, you know, might be his last contract out there, you're waiting up on certain things. Now, I think the Mets are going to have to figure out this Alonso stuff before they get to the pitching. Maybe they, I'm sure they're working on them at the same time, but I wonder if Alonso and what he signs for, and or they have to pivot to a Bregman, if that's going to impact whether they go with Manaea, or maybe they go down, make a trade. I heard Luis Castillo's name. Walker Buehler is a name that continues to be connected with the Mets. Nick Pivetta, though that's a draft pick, I think that's kind of a check-in on that. You know, there's a lot going on. I think the Mets, personally, on the pitching side, feel good about Roki Sasaki. I know everyone's got him penciled in with the Dodgers already, but Hefner and his reputation and the Mets' development of pitchers, I think they're making that a thing, whether it's real or imagined, whether they're marketing it, good for them. So they may be saying, okay, I'm going to get the big bat that I promised Soto. I'm going to go out and get one more big league pitcher of some status, whether it be a Manaea, Walker Buehler. I know Flaherty's been thrown around. I don't really see a lot of smoke there. I never thought they'd be on the Burns, Fried, Snell. I've been right on that. And then we're going to go out and sign that big bat, and then it's going to be a component-driven. Maybe they'll be opportunistic with the bullpen. I could see them looking to see how the musical chairs plays out with some of the bullpen arms, like a Kirby Yates. I could see them play musical chairs a little bit with some of the winkers of the world. Maybe they try to trade Marte for a bullpen arm or free up some space to do some things with other component-driven parts of the offense. But right now, I don't think they sign two big bats or two big pitchers. I think they sign one big pitcher of some big pitcher sorts, like a Manaea. And then I think they sign either Pete or maybe, and I keep hearing Bregman, and I wonder how serious that really is. But clearly, if they miss out on Alonso, or Alonso's market develops in a way that they don't like, that could be a pivot. And then the rest of it is going to be what you hired Stearns for. Find guys who are not necessarily top of mind or who you're thinking about that have some potential that could fit in from a components perspective onto the roster. And that's why this whole thing drags out. I mean, think about it. It all drags out because now some of that component-driven is, let's see where we find the best value. And that's because of analytics and information and what have you. So, you know, that's kind of where the Mets are at. It shows you why the winter drags. I'll tell you what, the one big other takeaway from the winter meetings here is how down I am on the media. The reaction to Soto signing with the Mets, the apologist, and I'm not just talking about Kay or Waldman or those connected with the Yankees or the Yes Network, the apologies made by the mainstream, the fact that they are covering Soto and Soto's big contract with the Mets in a way that almost like it's a bad thing, it's bad for the sport, the Mets are doing a bad thing, when you know if it was anybody else, especially if it was the Yankees or the Dodgers, it'd be the exact opposite. It's really disappointing, especially when you see guys like Passan. You know, even Jim Bowden has gone out of his way. I was listening to him this afternoon on MLB Network Radio to talk about how the Yankees are better off without Soto. We talked about this on the show. This is a top 10 hitter in baseball all time right now, run creation. I mean, obviously that could change because he's in the middle of his career. But as of today, on December 15th, this is a top 10 player in the history of baseball, going back to the beginning. And you can't tell me you could put together a better overall team in some ways, but you can't tell me losing that Judge-Soto tandem doesn't hurt, because that hurts. And that's basically what the Mets are trying to do. Now, before I get to Pete and Bregman and the Pete market, let me just say something real quick about the golden at-bat. Everybody jumped in when that was floated about this. You get one hitter once a game. You can bat any time. I don't know if they do it from the seventh inning on, or it could be from the start, where you could just say, hey, Jose's series up. Nope, come back. Soto, you're going to hit right now. Almost like a free pinch hitter. And it really aligns with where sports is going today, because it adds an element of action, an element of strategy, an element of excitement. In a way, it accomplishes what the NBA kind of is now. The NBA, because the advent of how the three-pointer now is a good shot and a shot that everybody could hit, no lead is ever safe. It used to be you're up 9 points with 2.5 minutes left in a NBA contest in the 90s, and pace had something to do with it, the game is over. That was a blowout. And if you're up by 15 or 20, forget about it. Now at the three-pointer, totally different world you're in with three-pointer. I mean, that's two turnovers and a possession. You get 9-0 run in a snap of a finger. So I think baseball's trying to bring that component to the forefront here with the golden at-bat. Now, and I'll say one thing in defense of it, and I'm not advocating for them to implement this. I don't like them messing with the sport in this manner. But I can understand it in a certain degree. And I know you're going to be surprised by me saying this. But when I first heard it, I understand it. And I'll give you one example as to why they want this possibly to be part of the rules. Think back to the Subway Series. I think it was either the first or the second game. It was probably the first game at Yankee Stadium. The second part, half of the Subway Series at Yankee Stadium. I believe the Mets won 3-2. And wasn't it there a couple of runners on or bases loaded and Aaron Judge was up and Jake Diekman struck him out? I don't have all the particulars here in front of me. But wasn't that, especially because everybody was sitting there, myself included, waiting for Judge to wreck the game and beat Diekman, because Diekman was so bad. And he was actually let go not too long after that. That was like his Mets moment. He never really pitched well for the Mets, gave up too many home runs, walked too many batters, fell behind too many guys. But he got Aaron Judge out in the Subway Series, so he'll go down in Subway Series lore. That at-bat will be talked about years from now. And that was Jake Diekman, and that was basically the golden at-bat. So at some point in the ninth inning with two outs in a Subway Series game, if it's Edwin Diaz or whomever, Aaron Boone could just go to Aaron Judge and say, whether it's his part in the lineup or not, say, okay, big guy, it's your at-bat. Now, if you deploy that once a game, maybe you deploy that in the first inning, in the second inning, bottom of the order, bases loaded, nobody out, pitcher on the ropes. Maybe you say, okay, I want to break open the game right now. So there is something to it. I don't like playing with the sport in that manner, but it does, out of all the rules that we've heard, because I don't like technology taking away from the human element. That's why I'm not big on the automatic strike zone, and I'm not big on this, okay, you could just challenge it and they'll go up to the booth and really quick they'll tell you it was a ball or a strike based on the strike zone. So here you go. So Edwin Diaz, you know, umpire calls strike three on the corner, you start celebrating, wait, oh, they'll just go to the booth, oh no, that's a ball, now you get back on the field. Like, you need to have a human element. At least with the golden at bat, it's adding some kind of human element to the game. And I've been against pretty much, I mean, as a guy that used to be the most progressive, going all the way back to the late 80s, a young kid, I always wanted them to expand the playoffs. I always, when the wild card was in play, I always felt there wasn't enough playoff teams. I always felt the way they did home field advantage for years was done half, you know what, with, you know, switching, flip of the coin. I mean, the Mets in the 80s had the best record in their leagues the two times that they made the playoffs. And both times they didn't have home field in the NLCS because of scheduling, where the Houston Oilers screwed it up for the Mets in 86 when they should have had it, and they flipped everything around, and then they didn't get it in 88 because it was the Dodgers' turn. It was the NL West turn. It's ridiculous. I mean, the Mets should have had home field there. Now, they had it in the World Series in 86, but that was because it was the National League's turn. So it was always like that, and they had the All-Star game to determine it. All sorts of goofy stuff when it should have just been best record. Like, there's so many things with progress, and I was against the pitch, not against the pitch clock, I was okay with that. I was against the base runner rules and the pickoff rules, which I think has the most impact on time, and I didn't like the runner on second, the ghost runner, but I think that that has, at least in the regular season, added some element of strategy, and it does get the games going. And look, this is an entertainment sport, I get it. The golden at bat, I'm not really feeling it, but I'm not 100% against it. And I know you're going to say, Mike, that's crazy. I'm not, because it's almost like giving the ball to LeBron late in the game or Jordan late in the game or your quarterback looking for your receiver. Like, baseball is the only sport, even in hockey, where you can't set things up for your big scorer. Baseball is the only sport where the lineup dictates who's up. So it could be Aaron Judge with the big at-bat against Diekman, or it could be Anthony Volpe, or it could be some backup second baseman who happens to get up at that time. Now, that's the charm of what baseball is. But imagine if you had that chip. You know, and every team has a Judge or a Soto or a Pete. I mean, there's so many different ways you could go, and you could deploy it whenever you want. It's almost like that card. And here's the other part. You really, when stadiums empty out late, let's say you're down 8-4, and the stadium starts to empty out on some tacking runs, you know, bottom of the lineup coming up, probabilistically against the big closer, not going to come back. But you get a couple of runners on and a run in, all of a sudden you're like, hey, it doesn't matter if it's the bottom of the lineup. Aaron Judge could come up. Soto could come up. It does add that little spice to late in the game or any part of the game and strategy and discussion. Again, I don't think it's going to happen. I think the purists, and I think there's more purists on this than there are progressives on this, but surprise, surprise, and I'd love to hear your thoughts. You guys know what Mike Silvat, talkaboutspodcast.com, no G. Maybe you guys have something to add to it and say I'm crazy and what have you. So, all right, let's move to the Pete Alonso market. So, surprise, surprise, Pete Alonso and Scott Boras believe that their value is different than what the Mets believe. Now, you heard Steve Cohen at the presser on Thursday say they love him back. Things are developing. There's been one report, and it makes sense, where a fan ran into Pete in Ireland when he was on a vacation with his wife, and basically Pete said, look, I'd love to be back, and it's up to Boras and Cohen. He's really handed this over to Boras. I've heard rumblings that teams like even the Phillies are in on Pete. Who knows if that's true? You haven't, and then Jeff Passan came out with this one-liner earlier in the week that there's really no market for Pete. Now, I heard that, everybody's heard that now the Yankees are considering him, especially if they can't get Clay Bellinger. I think that's partly putting a little scare into the Cubs to come to earth maybe with some of their financial demands as they try to dump Bellinger. It also could be a way for Boras to float that out there to get the Mets a little nervous. Do you really want your hero going across town? Imagine if it was a Soto for Pete switch. I mean, if it does come down to that, you do that every day, twice on Sunday. I mean, Soto's a top 10 offensive player all the time. Pete's a nice player. But here's the thing about Pete Alonso, and I won't even get into Bregman here in a minute because it is not a clear-cut choice where both of these guys are in their careers. Maybe at one point it would be clearer, but it's not. So if you take emotion and the homegrown aspect of Pete Alonso out of the equation, and you just look at him as a hitter, facts are facts. He's declined in slugging percentage. He has not looked the same in terms of consistency over the last couple of years. He can't hit the breaking pitch like he used to. And as he hits the age of 30, and you're looking at a 5, 6, 7 year contract, and we've talked about how right-handed batters, when they start to have their bats slow down, especially power hitters, even guys like Jeff Bagwell back in the day, Hall of Famer like Jeff Bagwell, how they become useless. Richie Sexton, another example of that. And then you have yourself a problem. You have yourself a very expensive DH, or maybe in Pete's case, he'll be mobile enough to play first base, but a guy that is an all or nothing, essentially Dave Kingman, and not the kind of offensive player that helps you build a sustainable offense, an offense that pushes the line. It's basically a guy that it's all or nothing. And if they go bad and they can't hit the side of a barn, it becomes ugly. Richie Sexton, again, falls into that category. So when you put this in a vacuum, it really doesn't make sense to sign Pete Alonso. In a lot of ways, and now if he wants a five-year deal, then I would say that would negate what I'm about to say. That's what we've heard about Christian Walker. Christian Walker's got a better glove. He, you know, in theory, you could get him for a shorter-term deal, even though he's older. But that may not be the case if he's looking for five. You know, you give me Christian Walker, or if the Yankees got Christian Walker on a three-year deal. And I know Pete's really good at scoops, so that and I think it was Sean Casey who said it on the MLB Network, that's like the most important thing of a first baseman. I agree. It's more important than range. Make the plays at you. Don't make errors. Range will forgive you for. Although I think Pete's not great at range, but he's not terrible. And scoop the ball out of the dirt, save errors, especially because sometimes Lindor or even Vientos could be a little erratic. And that's important. And he was at the top of the sport on that. And he did. And your eyes could tell you that he was really good. We never really had that tracked. And then when they started talking about that in the postseason. So you look at that in a vacuum and you say, why are we here pining for Pete Alonso? But then you think about the home run against Milwaukee and the energy he brings and the home run derbies and how he was this breath of fresh air in 2019 when logically Brody Van Wagenen and his front office were going to hold him back for a couple of weeks. And believe me, if they had done that, Pete would be scheduled to be on the roster next year. That he wouldn't have been a free agent. but he earned a spot in spring training. Every goal he set out since he's put a Mets uniform on, he's achieved. He was never the top prospect. There was plenty of doubters about how good he was. And, you know, he's a really good Mets story, and you'd love to see him go down and set the Mets home run record and be a Met at least for the next 4 or 5 years, and then after that, you see what happens. And I think when you start to look at the emotional aspect, and then you know, people could say, hey, Mike, after he dropped that pop-up, and we talked about this during that Game 3 in Milwaukee, if he dropped that pop-up, and yes, Diaz got out of an inning, which could have added some insurance runs that would have probably put the game away. If he didn't hit that home run in Game 3, and after that drop pop-up, would we be talking about something differently? Perhaps, but even so, you look at what's left. Soto initially, just by his presence, improves this lineup to nearly 5 runs a game. We did some of that math. Even if you put a league average first baseman, let's say they go out and they don't even bother with Christian Walker and they just bring like a Carlos Santana in, or an Anthony Rizzo, or even a Paul Goldschmidt, who's better than league average, but maybe that's what they are right now. They could do a 1 or 2 year stopgap there. That's possible. And maybe that's what you get. Let's say Santana, good glove, but more league average first baseman. Even with that, you have nearly 5 runs a game. You have to think Pete has more than that at this point. And they made a promise to Soto. They made a promise for another bat. They need another bat. A lot of what I'm talking about requires Vientos having a similar type of year. We're not sure, second time around the league, what you're going to get out of Vientos. Is he a middle-of-the-order hitter? Is he more of a 6 or 7 hitter? Can he be like the Mets version of Teoscar Hernandez? I think there's a lot of positives. He had a great postseason against elite pitching. But the league will catch up, and the league will humble you. So we have to still wait and see on that. So they really need another bat. Pete makes sense from the emotional standpoint. He plays first base. There's really only one other area, or two other areas, because the DH is kind of a fungible one. You can put Vientos at DH and bring in a Bregman. Or just go out and sign a Santander. I don't know if he would want a DH and then occasionally play the outfield. There's no room in the outfield, really, unless you want to put, you know, rest Nimmo at the DH spot here and there, rest Soto at the DH spot here and there. You can do that. But Santander's a guy that's going to want to play every day. He's not, you know, I talked about doing some component-driven stuff with Marte and Winker splitting time, if depending on what kind of market Winker gets at the DH spot. Jock Peterson's name has come up as a DH. There's a lot of things you could do with lefty-righty at DH, the component-driven. But if you want to have an everyday impactful hitter, the only options left are Pete Alonso and Alex Bregman. Now, part of me, again, you go in a vacuum and say, Bregman's got a glove. Bregman, if you're getting the Bregman with the gold glove that walks more than he strikes out, that has power, that can hit for average, then, you know what? You have something there. And obviously, you know, one of the other things about Bregman that everybody talks about is the Crawford boxes in Houston, Houston being a really good place to hit. But he really didn't hit much different on the road versus home last year. And if you look for his career, because I like these narratives, he's pretty much even home and away throughout his career. So that takes away a lot. He doesn't hit the ball particularly hard. I know the Mets and Ernie Dove and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago. We're looking more for guys that hit the ball hard. Pete would fall more into that. But if you looked at a situation where Bregman was signed to be your bat, shore up your defense, maybe you go component-driven at first. You got Vientos at the DH. Maybe you bring in a Carlos Santana for defense and to be the lefty caddy at first base. And you do something along those lines. You'll have Mauricio at some point. I don't know if he could play first base, but you could figure out that position. Joey Meneses? I got to learn how to say some of these guys' names. Meneses? Joey Meneses, he's a first baseman. I know that they signed him, and I know he's a minor league guy, but there's a guy, you know, has got some pop and a little bit older, but, you know, maybe they see something in him that we don't see. I mean, you do something like him with a platoon with him and a Carlos Santana. Maybe they do something like that if they go out and sign a Bregman. But what Bregman am I getting? Am I getting a Bregman? And this is the big question I have. What happened last year? Why did his walk rate drop like a rock? Why did he struggle so much for a big part of the year? Is there some kind of decline? I read some injury report with maybe some wrist or hand dings. You know, I know he's got an elbow injury. You know, he's had hamstring issues in the past. These are not debilitating injuries, but anytime you hear elbow or wrist, especially wrist, that could sap your power. That could make any hitter kind of fall by the wayside. So to me, that's a huge risk. What is he going to want? I mean, I think his market, and it's really interesting, both Pete Alonso and Bregman, who probably want closer to $30 million a year. And that was their thoughts a couple of years ago when they were thinking about free agency. And both, obviously, Boris clients. That's the funny part. So Boris is, again, after all the criticism from last offseason, here's Boris controlling the board again. I don't think they're going to get that. I think Matt Chapman set a market at third base. I think Freddie Freeman set a market at first base. I think the questions about Pete, which even now you thought maybe the Cubs would be in on him or Seattle would be in on him, you just don't hear much interest about him. Now, it's possible that teams are stealthily in the market. I mentioned the Phillies is a team that has kind of like been thrown out there on X. I don't know how that would work with Harper and the DH with Schwarber. But ultimately, I think it makes too much sense for both the Mets and Pete to make a deal. I think Pete will wind up getting about 25 to 26 AAV. I don't know if I would give him 7 years, but you know, maybe that's what it would require. Maybe you do 5 years and an option or some kind of opt-out if he thinks, you know, hey, if I have a really good year, give him, you know, a couple of years. Look, maybe he gets an opt-out after next year. Maybe he signs a five-year 125 with an opt-out after next season. And, you know, if he explodes and, you know, with Soto all of a sudden in the lineup, goes out and hits 50 home runs again, maybe there's a bigger market for him. We can see. It will be interesting with Pete, you know, how they play that in the lineup. Logically, you would have Soto second in the lineup, with Lindor first and maybe Pete third. But would Pete in front of Soto provide him some protection and maybe get him to see more fastballs? And if Vientos is who we think it is, maybe Vientos could be some protection for Soto. That's the one thing we all knew. And I know there's some debate on the analytics side about protection being a thing. Because think about it. I mean, other than the fact that Soto wasn't intentionally walked at all last year, I think he was intentionally walked twice because he's batting in front of a judge. That doesn't matter. I mean, they still pitched around him at times or tried to get him to swing at their pitch. It's all in a vacuum at this point. Good hitters are going to find a way to hit the one or two mistakes they get throughout a ball game and do damage. Where not so great hitters miss those pitches and typically don't get another one, and that's why they're not as good a hitter. So really, that's kind of where you're at with Pete Alonso. I don't see the market. Boris could continue to use the Yankees as a scarecrow and complain about Pete's value, and he's probably got some kind of book that he put together because of all the home runs he's hit and the fact that Pete has only Aaron Judge has hit more home runs than Pete, that he's telling you he's better than he is. The Mets are very aware of what they have. Cohen sounded like someone who wants to bring him back, but not at any price. And with Bregman being an option, and I think the Mets, and I think this is where the fans post-Soto are going to be disappointed, because I think they thought that Soto and signing Soto was an indicator that the Mets are just going to go all out on everybody. That's not the case. They will go all out, and they've said this. They've been public about this, and Stearns has been public about this. The right age, the right player, the right time, those kind of players like Soto, like Yamamoto was a year earlier, they will go out and overpay and do the big long-term, big contract. But they're not going to do it for everybody. They're not going to do it for Max Fried. They're not going to do it for Corbin Burns. Not because they're not good players or good pitchers. They don't believe that at that point in their careers and who they are, those are the kind of players that you want to do those legacy contracts. So you may see a lot more component-driven moves around Soto. And it's not because they're cheap or because they don't have imagination or they're moving too slow. It's because that's how you're going to manage a responsible luxury tax payroll. And that's how you're going to build a sustainable winner, because you don't want to put all your eggs. I mean, look, they could go out and say, look, this is the offseason. We're going to go out. We're going to sign Soto. We're going to sign Burns or Fried. We're going to sign Bregman or Pete and just go out and just spend money and go blow past the luxury tax. He could do that. And then guess what? Burns gets hurt. Maybe Bregman's done. And all of a sudden, now you got some bad money and you're back to square one where you are with Scherzer and Verlander. So I believe Ultimately, I think it makes too much sense for Pete and the Mets to get a deal done. Maybe they find a way to give Pete an opt-out so he could prove himself a little bit and go into a better free agent market, maybe. I don't think he's going to get more than 25 to 27 AAV. I'm guessing he probably wants 30. Bregman just makes me nervous in the sense where is everything about Bregman to me, he's a better player than Pete Alonso. He plays a more premium position, albeit a corner, better defensively. You know, better overall in the sense where he's a better hitter, you know, good plate recognition, walks more than he strikes out other than last year, but has power. Doesn't have Pete power, but has power. You know, it's possible that may be compromised a little bit with Citi Field, but, you know, without the Crawford boxes, but he's still going to hit. You saw the numbers. He still hits on the road. But he doesn't have what Pete has, which is that connection to the home crowd. And I think that that matters. I think that the fact that Pete grew up with the Mets, that he had that spectacular 2019 season when he won the job in spring training, won Rookie of the Year, and hit home run after home run after home run. I think the home run against Milwaukee, which will be talked about in Mets lore forever, which was pretty much the innocent climb, you know, that with the Lindor home run in Atlanta is going to be the signature moments of the innocent climb of 2024. And probably the most dramatic Mets postseason moment, maybe since the Buckner ball went through his legs. Maybe. I don't think that's saying a lot. I mean, there's been Grand Slam single and, you know, some other things there. The Pratt home run. You know, maybe you could put those up there, I'm sure. But Pete, that was pretty dramatic. I mean, that was a win or go home. That was a minute, you know, we were all sitting there waiting to be put out of our misery as Mets fans, and he goes and he hits that home run. I mean, I've never seen a wild game like that in the postseason in my lifetime. I think that's one of the best postseason games I've watched in my lifetime. Mets postseason game. So it just makes too much sense. I ultimately think they get a deal done. I think the lineup will be, ultimately it'll be Pete at first, McNeil at second, Lindor at short, Vientos at third. I think they go component-driven at the DH. They got Alvarez and Torrens behind the plate. You got Siri in center. You got Nimmo in left. You got Soto in right. I mean, Soto's going to need some help with the range. That's what you got Siri. Nimmo's got some good range in left, but, you know, not a good arm, but the other two guys can make up with their arm. You got some good defense. You know, Vientos, maybe he improves a little bit with his work ethic. He's passable at third. Where you want the defense at the key position, center, short, second, behind the plate, you're pretty good. You're pretty good if you're the Mets. So away you go, and you fulfill your promise to Soto to get him some protection in the lineup. There's no doubt that they will. Maybe there's a trade out there. You know, maybe there's something they could do in the Luis Castillo trade to bring some offense back from Seattle. I'm not going to speculate about that. But to me, the next move will be to fulfill this promise to Soto for a hitter, and then you move on to the pitching. And I'm not sure everything will get done before Christmas. I think we might see something this week, some movement this week. But, you know, I just think it makes too much sense for both sides. I think sometimes it's not just about the cold, hard numbers. It's the emotion of who Pete is, the fact that he's homegrown, the fact that he's played here and been successful here. And if you got the risk, because both Bregman and Pete are risks, there's red flags with both of their trajectory offensively. Go with the guy you know in those situations, and that's Pete Alonso. And that's where I'll leave you off on this segment of the Talking Mets podcast. So hope you enjoyed this show on Sunday. Come to you just a couple of days after we talked about the Juan Soto coronation, the Juan Soto press conference. We've got a smorgasbord of stuff out there we talked about, mainly Pete Alonso and Alex Bregman. Twitter Spaces at 7 o'clock. Hope you could join me. I think that's going to be recorded, so if you miss it, you could probably go back and listen. And we'll be here. Look, there'll be more news. Mets are going to sign a pitcher. Mets are going to sign another hitter. I keep promising to go through some of the value-driven moves. I owe you guys a trash or treasure. And every time I want to do it, then things get in the way, like the Juan Soto signing. So anyway, we'll have to see. But I want to thank everybody for tuning in to this latest edition of the Talking Mets podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You give me an Instagram, TalkingMets, no G. And don't forget the newsletter, Substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks on the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.
For the